Blog Talk Radio.
Citizen with Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystalyn Beek Larson and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Good morning.
Well, good morning.
Oh, it's so good to be back. I'm sorry I missed you guys all last week.
We missed you.
Missed you too,
in
yeah.
more ways than one.
Well, I am so glad to be with you today, and I'm so grateful for both of you. Thank you so much. And we also have with us our good friend who is planning a wonderful conference in Yosemite this year, Ms. Diane Labreck. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Paula. Hi, Crystalyn. Hi, Andre.
Good morning.
Good
Welcome
morning,
to
Diane.
Talk.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. Is it going to be a French program?
well,
we wouldn't know.
No,
what
I don't think so. Yeah.
Andre would know what you were saying, but I wouldn't. I could pick up a little bit.
you know one thing, Paula. Après vous, mais non, après vous. Like DuPont and DuPont.
All right. There you go. DuPont and DuPont. Well, you have a wonderful event coming up, and it's one I know I'm looking forward to. And I was, and Crystalyn also. And Andre, were you at the first event in Montreal?
I was.
Oh, yeah. So all of us, all four of us were at the first event in Montreal, and that was in 2010. And it was such a wonderful event, and I just enjoyed it so much. It's a celebration of spiritual relationship, and we join together as one family. And we know from reading the Arantia book, it reiterates more than anything I've ever read, I think, that we are all one family under God and one spiritual family, a cosmic family, if you will. And I think that was your intention, to celebrate that fact of spiritual family, and to draw us all together to just rejoice and have fun. And you had a great epiphany about the word festival.
Yes, I remember.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say, first of all, when you mentioned at the beginning, you have a great event coming up, Diane, I would like to add, we have a great event. We,
yeah.
All of us, your Rancho Book readers, have a great event. It's not my event, it's our event. Everybody's trying to serve God and Jesus and Michael and Mother Spirit to the best we can. God gives us talents to the way He chooses, and that's the way I can serve, so we all serve in each our way. And this project, the United Urantia Family Festival, was not something I cannot take the credit, because it was an inspiration. I only feel that I'm doing what I'm being told to do, in the sense that, and I don't want to sound like a fanatic or a mystic or anything. It's just that, to me, we should all be in communion with God and all be in connection with Jesus and helping him, Jesus Christ, Michael, helping him to express himself, to continue to live through us and express himself through us. And the event by itself, as it says, is very simple. It's open to all, it's welcoming all the Urantia Book readers and even other people like families, mates, people that discovered the beauty of that fifth epochal revelation by the very name of it. The United. Does it keep us united? Yes. Yippee, let's go. Urantia. It's related to the Urantia Book, to the revelation. There are so many wonderful works related to that, but yet at the same time, the event, this family gathering, is about the fifth epochal revelation on our planet Urantia, known as the Urantia Book. And then family, does it create a feeling of family? Yes, it does. It may raise at times a little disagreements, little this, little that, but it's, I come from a family of 12, like I've said so many times. We didn't always argue, agree. We didn't always argue, actually. It's a good lapsus. We didn't always argue, you know. So are we a family? This is what it's meant for. And then festival, yes, the epiphany, because when I was praying and telling Jesus, geez, why the word festival? Because festival, like the jazz festival, all kinds of festivals, people get stoned, get drunk, get this and get that. And I felt like this is a little strange for a spiritual event. And then I was sent to look into my encyclopedia of word origins. And when I looked up the word festival and I discovered what it was saying, I understood, oh, my God, your wisdom once again, because festival is it described as a celebratory ceremony, particularly of a religious nature. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, this is exactly what it's about. So when we gave birth to, when we all gave birth to the United Urantia family, in Montreal in 2010, where you were there, Andre, Paula, Kristalyn, we were all there. It was, I will always remember the incredible program you did on Cosmic Citizen Live from the event on Saturday. I'm sure you all remember. Mm-hmm. It felt so electric, you know, it was so vibrant of spirituality and all those guests that you had on your program. So when I prayed and asked, where do you want, Jesus, please tell us where you want us to meet. We are your family. Where do you want us to meet in 2013 for the next triannual event? Just like now we have the Fellowships triannual event, the Urantia Association triannual event, and now the Urantia Family triannual event, each with a different mission. And so the answer that came was Yosemite Park, and especially the Grizzly Giant, and it's on Jesus' birthday. And so at the time, not being American myself, I don't know every corner of the United States by heart, and so it's only later on that I discovered what is around Yosemite Park, and specifically the Grizzly Giant. And to my greatest joy, I felt like, oh my God, this is going to be an extraordinary event. And it all started to unfold and place itself just like the pieces of a puzzle, and it is continuing to do so. And it's I believe it will be a beautiful event, and you and Kristalyn were the very first two registrants. So I thought, this is meaningful. It's going to be something wonderful as an event. So I just had to clarify what the United Urantia Family Festival is about.
Well, great.
And I would
you.
Like to clarify, too, that this, for our listeners, that this is not a conference. This event is going to be, in many ways, significantly different than a Urantia conference. The plan really is to have it be a more social recreational, worshipful, bonding type of event. Isn't that right,
right,
Diane?
Absolutely, and I'm so glad you mentioned it, Krystalyn. Thank you, because your listeners have to know that the program is divided. First of all, it's going to be on from August 20th to the 24th. In August, coming up this summer, and the program is divided in such a way that it's going to be so balanced. All morning, we're all meeting at Camp Wawona. By the way, Camp Wawona is in Yosemite Park. They are the only place that can receive a large number of people. We can be up to 300 people. Registrations are going very well. I'm very enthused about everything. We invite everyone to join us. By the way, I should say, if anyone wants to see, our website is very simple. It's the acronym of the event, the United Urantia Family Festival, TUUFF.org. So all they have to do is dial in TUUFF.org, and they can have all the information. They can register. And I have to say, I would like to say a funny story because about Camp Wawona. When I found it after months and months of research and bang the door, everybody would bang the door to me, and as soon as I would mention either Urantia book or Urantia conference or a large number or for different reasons, it was always no, 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 no. And just as I was about to be discouraged and give up, this came up, Camp Wawona. And when I called them, they are Seventh-day Adventist camp. And I thought, oh, Dr. Sadler, you know, he was with the Seventh-day Adventist. And then they answered like, oh, we'll be happy to receive your group, ma'am. And so I was very happy, and I went to visit the place. And then I had someone, a Urantia book reader from Europe, maybe I can mention his name, Michael McIsaac. I love Michael. And Mike wrote to me an email and said, Diane, would it be possible to organize the event a little earlier because some of us are going to school and we want to be there, but we don't want to miss the event? So I answered back, sure, Mike, I'll do all my best to. It's our family gathering, so let's do the best we can to gather as many people as we can. So I contacted Camp Wawona again, and then I said, would it be possible to have it for, let's say, July or something like that? So let me check. And then he came back to me and he said, actually, you know, I have to tell you one thing. The whole of 2013 is booked from the opening of the season to the closing of the season. There's only one week that's available, August 21st. I laughed. I said, really? How about we keep it? You know? And so we're going to be meeting on Jesus' birthday. I wrote back to Mike. I said, Mike, I tried my best, but we cannot. And I find that, to me, I see the hand of God moving along, because we're all going there for Jesus, with Jesus, and for Jesus, so much so that that is the theme of our event, you know, under the watch care of Jesus in the presence of angels. And so we have this beautiful 40-acre land, Camp Wawona, that will receive us. They just finished building a beautiful outdoor amphitheater. Terry McCade sent me an email saying, a video saying, Diane, look how beautiful it is. We're right there in the midst of the sequoias and the rocks and everything outdoor. So in the morning we will gather and get all the information that's going on in the dissemination relating to the dissemination of the Urantia book.
I want to just interrupt you just a real quick second, on Diane, to also let our listeners know that even though it says it's a camp, that there are buildings, you know.
Oh, yes.
Dorms and yurts and cabins. So
Cottages,
right. So when, you know, it's not for tent camping.
Right. No teepees, no camps, no RVs. It's a real, like I said, it's 40 acres of land. They receive students that go for weeks of training. And so there's a big cafeteria. The land is beautiful, the place. There's going to be a temple for the father. There's rooms. There are cottages, A-frame cottages. There's even covered wagons for the truth seekers and the Yaya committee. There's a beautiful Olympic-sized pool. It's a very modern place. It's not like a camping ground like we would expect with people laying down their tents, you know. So thanks for clarifying, Crystalline. And so just to finish the answer, every morning we will gather. There's no breakout sessions. We all gather outside at the amphitheater for prayer, worship, and then for special presentations with people like, let's say, John DeToy from South America, or for some people from Europe, or, you know, readers that will tell us about the dissemination of the book in their service mode. And after that, we have lunch, and in the afternoon, it's free time. There's going to be time for painting, for going for family activities,
different kinds of recreational activities.
That's right. And then after that, at night, we're going to have an outdoor dinner, and then after that, there's going to be celebration, a different program. Everybody can see that on our website. At night, there's going to be a sharing, because what would be nice is to inform people that in the morning, when people will go for breakfast at the cafeteria, everybody will look at their name, and let's say it will say Andre Rodatis. Oh, Andre Rodatis, today, August whatever, you belong to Family 17. So, or you, Paula, or you, Crystalline, you will go and find out who you belong with. And every day there will be many family groups or family units to help us develop that family, that fraternity, that brotherhood together, feeling of spiritual family. And so at breakfast, you go and you sit at table 17, and you get to meet your family members for the day. So all day long, you will be with that family. And so you meet someone from Africa, from South America, from United States, from Canada, from everywhere. So you introduce yourselves. You get to meet new brothers and sisters that are your Rancho Book readers. So you don't go there and hang out with your husband all week. You meet other people. And so all day you stay with that family. In the morning, while we do all the family gathering and family information and all that, we are together. And in the afternoon, there's going to be many activities. Go to the Swinging Bridge. It's beautiful. I've been there a few times now to go and organize the event. And it is magnificent. It's just like sublime, just like the woods can be, and when you're in the Yosemite Park, I mean, it's just like wonderful. And so in the afternoon, every day there's going to be a theme to work on, and instead of going to a breakout session, we're going to do that in nature. So we're going to go in nature later on. I hope we have time to talk about Jeffrey Waddell's project in nature. And at night, we will be sharing. Like on August 21st, on Jesus' birthday, at night we're going to have a dance, a party, and the Yaya group is in charge of the dance party with Liz Craig, so that's going to be wonderful. So every little detail has been taken care of and thought of carefully, just to make sure that we cover a real, true family celebration. Like you said so well, Crystalline, it's a family bonding experience, and we're not going there for the intellectual part. There are other events that take care of that. For us, it's to celebrate our family spirit in Jesus Christ, Michael, and God, our Heavenly Father.
Sounds wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah, it sure does. I love the inspiration that, you know, the balance of having just a celebration and just having fun and worship and prayer and time for spiritual matters and not just intensive study. We know that study is a very good thing and, you know, one of the essential things to civilization, but rest and play is also. And just to be with your family and be in love, that's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
And I find, too, that the idea of playing together and in doing recreational enjoyment together is a unique experience for our Urantia community. We're frequently very involved in intensive study. And while it's really great for the mind, it isn't always unifying. You know, it's frequently, we love the fact that the Urantia book doesn't promote the idea of uniformity of thinking.
Right.
And so we are, you know, given the opportunity to disagree on many, many theological issues that we can discuss many cases till we're blue in the face. But the real exciting thing for me is the experience of bonding and of learning how to love one another, even when we come from really diverse backgrounds and diverse ways of thinking.
Exactly. I would like to say something because, Chrysalyn, you are on the a member of the organization team, actually the chair for program, and I would like to share with your audience a beautiful email that we received from another member of the organizing team, Charles Olivier. I have high regards for Charles. And one day after we had this conference call to organize the event, we received an email from Charles that was so beautiful that I would like to say it. It's very short, but it sums it all up, and it touched me so deeply. And when I spoke with Charles a few days ago, I asked him, I said, can I share this with the audience on Cosmic Citizen? And he said, Diane, please go and do so if it can serve to the United Urantia Family Festival, so be it. And so it goes like this. He had answered back as an email to talk about the conference call that we had, and then he ended to say, I wish to repeat that, in my opinion, and again, I say this coming from Charles, which I see as such a lot of wisdom, you know, a man of God, a beautiful man of God, like so many in the Urantia movement. And he said, I wish to repeat that, in my opinion, the gathering to celebrate Michael's name and he put and in bold and italic, so to celebrate Michael's name and his earthly birthday and the fifth epochal revelation, and the place where the archangels reside at their divisional headquarters will be a human event heretofore on an incomparable, in bold and black, in italic, on an incomparable moral scale for Urantia. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. I thought it was so beautiful and touching that I said, this has to be heard by as many people, as many souls as possible, because I don't know if you remember, Crystalline, when you told us that you were talking about the Archangel's headquarters to people, and people were thinking that it is mostly an Archangel's headquarters for Urantia. And then you told me that it is a divisional headquarters. You remember when we had that conversation?
I do.
Indeed. And so I went, yes, and I went in the Urantia book and I searched it, not that I didn't believe it, on the opposite, I was so happily surprised about that. And in the Urantia book, it says a very beautiful quote in paper 37. They say, the archangels, just a second, yes, the archangel corps of Nebadon is directed by the firstborn of this order. And in more recent times, a divisional headquarters of the archangels has been maintained on Urantia. It is this unusual fact that soon arrests the attention of extra-Nebadon student visitors. And then they say, do you grasp the significance of the fact that your lowly and confused planet has become a divisional headquarters for the universe administration and direction of certain archangels' activities having to do with the Paradise Ascension Scheme? And then I went like, wow, this is going to be beautiful. So I called Carolyn Kendall. Many people know Carolyn Kendall, who lives in Chicago, this wonderful, wonderful lady. And she was there in the time of Dr. Sadler. Her father was part of the first group with Dr. Sadler and the Revelation. And Carolyn had the privilege and the blessing to, we've become friends over the years. I love her, and I admire her truth and honesty and directness. And she said to me that she was Dr. Sadler's personal assistant for a few years. And so we were talking about it, and I asked her, I called her, I said, Carolyn, is it really true that the Grizzly Giant in Yosemite Park is the Archangel's headquarters? And Carolyn said, oh, yes, Diane. I thought it was cute because she said, oh, yeah, Doc mentioned it several times. And I asked her two or three times to confirm, to make sure that it was not just a story made up, because we know it's not written in the Urantia book. But yet at the same time, she said it was true. And so she said, oh, yes, it is so. And it was interesting because she said that Dr. Sadler was told that if you could only see the legions of angels gathered there to sing, all singing, all hail the power of Jesus' name. And so we have a beautiful video that's been made with Mo Siegel's painting. Mo was great enough to allow us to use all the pictures of the paintings that they have ordered, him and his wife, Jennifer, and based on the theme of the Urantia book. And on that theme of Mo's paintings, we've done a beautiful video with the theme song, so that, because we will be there gathering to praise and worship as the power of a group, you know, to actually help this beautiful phenomenon that's happening around the world right now. And so it's going to be very, very meaningful to be at the Grizzly Giant on Jesus' birthday. And we know that all arrivals happen at noon and all departures are at midnight. So we will be there at noon at the Grizzly Giant, everyone, to sing and celebrate Jesus' birthday. And people that go on our website will have the detail. And
now, what do you mean by all arrivals and departures?
Yeah, yeah, you need to clarify that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thanks. I'm sorry. Okay. In the Urantia book, they do say that, you know, the angelic, because your program today, last week, by the way, was a great program. I so look forward to the second part today. And you're talking about the planetary seraphic government and the angels and all that. And the Urantia book, they do mention that angelic arrivals on Urantia and departures happen at noon and midnight. And so I thought to myself, wow, Jesus, that's going to be something else. We will gather there at noon on the exact day of your birthday. It's the first time that a large group of conscious minds, readers of the fifth epochal revelation, will gather there at the archangel, the divisional archangel's headquarters on Urantia on August 21st, your birthday, at noon, the time of your birth. And at that time of arrival, where they say that visitors, just like I read, you know, this is, as they said, this is this unusual fact that soon arrests the attention of extra-Nibidon student visitors. So they say that at noon, all arrivals are done on the angelic part. And so I was thinking,
so that means the visitors arrive at that time.
Yes. And angels and everything, everyone, so that even though we will not be able to see them with our eyes, we will be in the presence. And all this will happen at the same time. This is why we have a beautiful worship program at the Grizzly Giant with a group of people. Marion Brundage is in charge of that, with Barbara Newsom, with Christina Seaborn. There's going to be live music. There's going to be a worship at the Grizzly Giant at noon, and it's going to be a very moving moment, because it will be right there, right then, that all of us, multiplied by the number we are. If we are 200-300, it's not going to be 200-300. It's going to be 200 multiplied by 200, the exponential factor. So the power of souls gathered together to worship our Lord and Creator at that very strategic place on earth, at that strategic time, space and time gathered together with a mindful gathering of conscious readers, is going to be a very profound experience. And Terry McCade sent me a beautiful postcard, and he wrote, "Dear Diane, I believe the gathering of the Urantia family around the Grizzly Giant on August 21st will be the believer's symbolic rendezvous with Christ Michael in faith and love." And I thought, how beautiful. So to me, it will be a personal pilgrimage and a collective family pilgrimage. And I feel that Jesus is going to be Jesus Christ, Michael. I say Jesus because he's so alive. And we know that at the local universe level, it's Michael. And so Jesus Christ, Michael, will be smiling that on his birthday, we will be consciously acting together like that in that spirit. It is something to be very, very profound. Anyway.
Well, and just being there on the 21st of August is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
You know, your Rancho Book readers will be gathering all over the world on that day to celebrate the birth, the earthly birth of Jesus, according to the Urantia book. And
yes,
it clearly states that he was born August the 21st, 7 BC. So, Andre, what birth date would that make this celebration? What birthday would we be celebrating?
This will be 1,983 years. Jesus, if he were alive today on Urantia, would be 1,983 earth years old, but clearly he is 1,983 earth years old as the human Jesus. Because that consciousness, it's not just the Son of Man still lives in the Son of God.
Exactly.
And so, and is actually ruling Nebadon. So
wouldn't
we're told,
he be over 2,000 years old?
Yes, you're right. You're right. He,
it's because
correct.
We've already gone past his 2000th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I'm
not
sorry.
To question
I'm,
your
I'm
math
sorry.
Here, but I have
well,
to
you should question
your
my
math.
I'll tell you why I said that. I've been obsessed with the fact that we're getting close to the 2000th anniversary of the resurrection.
Me
it's 1,983 years that we just celebrated the resurrection, so that was on my mind. So absolutely, you're right. It's clearly it's 2019.
There
birthday.
You go.
Yeah.
Actually, can I say 2023? Because it's 6 years before. In 94, it was 2,000 years old. And 94
yeah.
to 2000 is 6, and 13 is 19.
Yeah.
So. Oh, I see what you said. Okay, Andre. 2019 total.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Oh, great. Thanks. I was trying to follow what you were saying.
Well, it's, you know, it's hard because you think it would be easy if you're thinking from the year 2000 or from the year zero to
right.
now.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you're thinking.
I'm
because
sorry
you
to
talked about the resurrection.
Right.
Well, I confused it all by saying 1983 in the beginning. Just chalk that up to it being like near the end of my day.
But,
right.
but from our perspective,
since you work nights,
a long time
you're
ago.
Getting to the end of your day when most of us are either in the middle of our day or beginning.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. I would like to say we're going to have soon, in a few days, we will send an email to all our mailing list, and we will invite people who want to buy a T-shirt, a commemorative T-shirt. We have this beautiful T-shirt that's coming up. And thanks to Lisa Crow, who's done our website from the very beginning 3 years ago. Thank you so much, Lisa. And she's helping us. She's with different parts, the artistic part of it. And we worked out a T-shirt that's going to be so beautiful. There's a picture that was taken by an artist, a man from Italy, Luca Fogli. And I found this picture and I sent it to Lisa and I said, wow, Lisa, look at that. And it's got whoever's been there, the grizzly giant is an amazing tree. It's like the monarch of the forest. It's just beautiful. And he took the picture that is superb. And then I just put on top of the picture and at the bottom of the picture, on the top of it, a quote from Jesus who said, I am the vine and you are the branches. And then it says, how does it go? I am the vine and you are the branches. The branch will die if it is separated from the vine. And you see the majestic grizzly giant with all the vine and then all the branches, you know. And at the bottom, it's so beautiful because you were there, Crystalline, and you remember there's a pathway to follow to go to the grizzly giant?
Right.
Yes, and so the Mr. Fogli, he took the picture of the giant grizzly and with part of the pathway to the tree in the front. And so at the bottom it says, another quote from Jesus, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man goes to the Father except through me. And there is the pathway that leads to the giant grizzly. And then, you remember in the tree, there's a big black opening because of fires or different reasons. And it looks like a door. And a dear friend of mine here in Montreal, Pierre Routier, when I sent him his an example to have his opinion, he said, Diane, that's beautiful. Not only does it look like perfectly adapted for the vine and the branches, but at the same time, it looks like a welcoming door, like, come, come, you're welcome. I wait for you. And so it's going to be a superb T-shirt to commemorate the United Urantia Family Festival of 2013. And so people will be invited to buy it if they want. And so it's going to be nice. And then when I went there about a month ago, Lisa and I, we were there to start preparing the rooming because we want to put people in the right buildings and the right rooms and all that, plus other seeing over the meals and everything. And then Lisa looked at me and said, look, my boyfriend gave me this beautiful little nano flashlight, and it's good for 10,000 hours, something like that. Anyway, thousands of hours. And I looked at it. It's barely an inch long. It's so beautiful and so small. It will go anywhere. And then we were at night at the at Camp Awona, and it's in the forest, so it's not like a downtown city, you know. There's no lights at night. So I wanted to go for a walk in the woods, and I couldn't see anything. So Lisa said, hey, take my flashlight and use it, Diane. And then I realized when I was outside, it was pitch black. I could not see anything. And then I turned his little one-inch long nano flashlight, and bang, it looked like I was just, you know, surrounded by light. And then I had this idea, that's going to be beautiful. We're going to make a gift to every participant to get that little light, so at night when we go to our rooming quarters or whatever, we're going to be like little fireflies going in the woods, you know, little fireflies walking around. So I made a research. I found a company that makes keychains, and I asked the man, I said, I have a special request. Can I have a keychain made special for flashlight, and I want a quote on it? So he said, sure, we'll do that for you. So the flashlight is going to be offered as a gift to every participant, and on the keychain, it has another quote of Jesus. So that's the Jesus event. So on the one side, I got the exact azure blue code from the Urantia Foundation for the three concentric circle. So we're going to have on the one side azure blue on white, the three concentric circles, and on the other side, azure blue background with white lettering, Jesus saying, I am the light of the world. Mm-hmm. And it says underneath the Urantia book and the three papers that are quoted for having Jesus say, I am the light of the world. So at night we will see all the light of the world going like little fireflies in the woods, you know. That's going to be really nice. So all kinds of beautiful things like this are happening along, and it's so nice.
Well, and you've really worked hard to keep this event affordable. Can you touch a little bit on what the cost is going to be so people know it's really not going to be that expensive?
It's not, actually. Thanks, Paula, for asking. It's very reasonable to me. It's within the range of all the events we've had with the fellowship, with the association when I was in South America last year for their triannual event, their beautiful triannual event that they had in Medellin, Colombia. It's $395 U.S., including everything, and that includes the 4 nights of sleeping at Camp Awona, 12 meals, and they're very concerned. I mean, they're Seventh-day Adventists, and you know, whoever knows the Seventh-day Adventist people, they're very focused on health, and so everything is cooked with love, with health in mind, with quality food, you know, fresh food, everything. Paulette, the chef, cooks beautifully well. We were there 3-4 times, and every time it's a delight to be there. And we've worked out I'm a nutritionist myself, so I went there and sat down with her for hours, and we planned the meals. And so it includes all the 12 meals. It includes all the family activities because they will have trained staff to help everyone. It includes
and
the registration
to
the conference.
I want to just interrupt now and focus on how much we do get for our registration fees. This is really special because all of the recreational activities, I think, with the exception of the horseback riding, is free.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to go canoeing or you want to go rock climbing or whatever, you're going to have trained experts helping with that activity, and then there's no additional cost.
That's wonderful.
So it's kind of like going, well, it's not like a resort, but it's like going to a prepaid resort.
An all-inclusive or something.
Because it's all-inclusive.
It is. It is all-inclusive, and it's really nice. They have beautiful activities right on the spot, and they're beautiful people. They're so nice, and it's going to be a joy to be together, but not just to have fun to pass time. It's going to be with a theme in mind every day, so that instead of going in a classroom and you know, breaking our minds to figure out something, we're going to be in nature laughing together, like you said so well, Crystalline. There's got to be reversion, time for reversion. Yet, at the same time, we grow together, so as we keep this theme question in mind, we enjoy this beautiful lot, 40-acre piece of land that they have, and we go on the swinging bridge, and we go here and there, and then we reconvene together at supper time, and we have this beautiful outdoor barbecue dinner, and the cafeteria is open and everything, so that people can actually, at night, we will reconvene together, and we will do family sharing. So the representative of each family unit will have a representative. So let's say you, Andre, Paula, and Crystalline, you all belong in each a different family group. So you go in for the day, and someone says, hey, Paula, you want to be our representative for our family? Sure, I'll do that. So at night, and then Crystalline, hey, how about you are the one? Sure, I'll do it with pleasure. So at night, we share together, and we listen to every family representative, so that we will have a secretary who will take note, and we will take in suggestions, comments that were passed on to help us. How can we become a better and better and better family group under Jesus' watch care? We are His family. We are His children. He wants us to become more and more and more united, so that one day in the long future, when all of us will be traveling very far, there will be a united Urantia family, and there has to be a start somewhere. We are the nucleus of it. We're giving birth to it. We're helping. The baby's only 3 years old. It's going to be 3 years old this summer, and it's going well. And so together we're going to do that. And how can we help one another to grow together? We have a single aim, and that is the dissemination of the Urantia revelation, and how can we best use our God-given talents to serve the Master well, to serve our Master with love and service in each our field of expertise, not to attack, judge, condemn each other. No, how can we help one another, love one another, uplift one another, you know, and so we grow together. And we get to love one another as he loved us.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you have, by any chance, a list of some of the activities that we can engage in at the for the breakout sessions?
Yes, I could. I sent a list of, I have one here. As we talk, I just want to say while we are looking for this, there's going to be, your listeners should know that Garth Jameson wrote to me and said, Diana, I would love to participate and offer a pre-retreat. So we're so happy. Thank you, Garth, to have suggested your loving service. Everyone loves Garth for his retreats. And so people who want, they can come the day before and arrive the day before. They have to know that by arriving the day before, it covers one more night to sleep over at Temple Wona, so that will be $37 extra that people can pay cash upon arrival. And at the same time, by arriving on Monday, on Tuesday, all day after breakfast, all morning, all afternoon, they can have a pre-retreat. It booked up very fast. And God said to me at the beginning, it's limited to the first 25. I wrote back to him, God, it's long been filled out. So he said, open the door, whoever wants to come. And so we're going to be many people that will be at God Jameson's pre-retreat. And so that's going to be very nice. And on, also another thing I wanted to say is that many people know our brother Jeffrey Wattles, and I think you know him well, Crystalline.
I do.
Jeffrey? Yes, and maybe you could speak about a bit of, while I look for the list, about Jeffrey's beautiful project.
Jeffrey has started, he's a professor in Ohio, and he, philosophy professor, and he started a special project. And recently, I don't know how long he's been doing it, but of trying to get his students to really experience the beauties of nature. And so it's built into his curriculum for them to spend a certain number of weeks actually going out, spending time in nature, and then contemplating, writing about it, and sharing their experiences in a journal kind of situation. And he shared some of the writings he's gotten from his students with a couple of us, and oh my gosh, they're really profound, profoundly beautiful. So for anyone who's interested, he's offering that to our participants, and those who are interested can sign up ahead of time with him to experience that same kind of project on their own before they arrive, and then continue that experience through their stay at Yosemite. He's also going to be presenting a brief history of John Muir's Yosemite.
Oh.
You know, when I was some time back, my husband and my little girl and I did a journey through the giant redwoods, a journey through Northern California, and we went to Muir Woods, and we went to Avenue of the Giants, and we later went to Yosemite and Kings Canyon. And but on this particular journey, we parked a car and just decided to walk through this beautiful fairy forest with just covered with ferns and clover and giant redwoods, and we were just in such a magical, reverent space. I mean, when you're with trees that are that old and that big, if you love trees like I do, you immediately become deeply, deeply reverent. And we were all, the three of us, and May was just little. She was maybe 3 years old, and we were so reverent as we hiked through this beautiful, magical forest with the light filtering down through these giant trees and just electric green everywhere. It was so beautiful, and we came upon this gigantic stump. Gee, this stump had to have been, you know, 10 feet across of an ancient redwood that was cut down for lumber. And next to it was a quote, a placard that, with a quote from Teddy Roosevelt. And the couple that found it actually, and I can't remember their name. I wish I could.
Oh, yeah, I remember
They were conservationists. They became, when they saw this stump that had been left behind, they were emboldened and impassioned to preserve the giant redwoods. And, of course, Theodore Roosevelt was a tremendous conservationist. And there's a plaque next to this stump that says, "What a shame to have cut down something that stood before the pharaohs walked to make shingles for our houses," you know. And it was so profound, it just hit me like a ton of bricks, you know, that these trees were standing when Jesus walked on earth. And so you think about that in light of this, where we're going, in light of Yosemite, and here's a national monument that Roosevelt had so much to do with creating and preserving, and this beautiful treasure that's been preserved for us and for all generations. And to think that, you know, your ranch and lore says that the archangels meet there daily, and the seraphic planetary government, which we're going to be talking about in the next hour, meets there daily. And this is where we're going. If you've not seen Yosemite, if you've never seen Yosemite, I have to say you must see it, and there wouldn't be a better time in your life to see it than with this particular group of people in this
magical on Jesus' birthday,
his 2019th birthday. Thank you, Andre, for that. And you know, to just share the exquisiteness. I mean, the Urantia book tells us over and over and over again that the place where we will get in touch with God more than anywhere else is the great cathedral of nature. And when you're out amongst these trees, there is no cathedral on earth more profound, more beautiful and moving than this. And if you don't feel close to God there, I hate to tell you, you probably won't feel close to Him anywhere. But so,
well, and it's the combination of these amazing giant forests and these incredible mountain vistas and these valleys teeming with wildlife, and
it's just exquisite.
Incredible vistas around every corner. It's a gasp of beauty.
Yes.
Oh yes. Actually, you know what I would like to say, and a very important thing, because when I met, when I was in Colombia, South America last year for the Urantia Association's triannual, Jeffrey Waddle was there, and then he looked at me and said, "Diane, I think I can help with the event next year." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I wrote an article about the beauty of Yosemite and nature and all that." And you know that John Muir was the one who founded the Sierra Club, and he was the one who was responsible more than anyone else for getting Yosemite National Park to be protected by the U.S. Congress. And so he said, "I would like to send you the article." He did, and I loved it, so we got back in touch together. And he said, "I have this idea of a project that we could offer to the people that will participate at the United Urantia Family Festival, and that is to involve people with to realize the beauty of nature and to bathe in it, so much so that what we could do is we could send them, because he's the one originating with this project, and he will send in a few days, when I will send a mass email to everyone, Jeffrey's invitation will be on the email to invite whoever wants to participate with his supervision and Barbara Newsom's help as well to look at some, to read some quotes from the Urantia book in line with the beautiful life of Jesus and nature and so on and so forth. And then an article on John Muir, who realized divine beauty and the glory of harmony like that in nature. He communed with God in wild nature. And then to go around their environment and pay attention to nature. And while they do that, they will be able to write down their appreciation of the beauties of nature that they are realizing, being conscious of. Write a 4 to 6 page article about that, a review, and then send it in to Jeffrey. And at Yosemite Park, Jeffrey will make a beautiful presentation on John Muir's story, history, and he will do some presentation of some of the people that have participated. So whoever feels called to participate in that project, which will be beautiful, like you said, Crystalline and Paula, I invite everyone to do that. There will be an email. He will explain how it goes. It's very, very simple because we're running out of time. I would have loved to go more in depth with it, but they will get an in-depth explanation, and we will be the ones savoring in the work of all those people that will have participated. And it's a fun project. It's a beautiful project. And he was describing how the giant sequoias are the king of all conifers, not only in size, but in, that's John Muir, but also in sublime majesty of behavior and port. And that is exactly what I observed when I first saw the grizzly giant. I looked at it and I went, oh my God, and it was like majestically standing there. I am the monarch of this forest. It was magnificent. And so we will be there, and there's going to be sitting around because there are places that everyone can sit. So we will have a beautiful, beautiful worship service for Jesus' birthday. Oh, I think we will bring our boxes of Kleenex, you know?
Of course.
And our flashlights.
And just so, you know, because we're down to the last 3 minutes here, I just want to reiterate, if you want to join in this wonderful event, just go to www.tuuff.org. So that's tough with two U's and two F's, tuuff.org, to register and learn all about it. And if you want to go to see the camp where we're going to be staying, Camp Wawona, you can check it out and find out all about the camp at www.campwawona, and that's spelled WAWONA.org, campwawona.org. And that's coming up this August 2013, a beautiful event for the United Urantia Family Festival, and a beautiful venue for it in the middle of the giant redwoods right next door to Yosemite National Park. It's going to be magical, and you won't want to miss it, so please do register. You just have to put down a down payment to hold your spot, and they've worked out all the details. It's going to be great.
Can I ask something, Paula, please?
Sure.
Online, because we, as I said, the United Urantia family is a little tiny baby, 3 years old. We're not a big organization yet. Not organization, but I mean we're not a big, we haven't been there for 50 years. And so some people have asked us, some people who dearly, profoundly want to be there on Jesus' birthday in this communion of souls, have asked us for sponsorship. Like I said to them, at this time of the event, we don't have much money for sponsoring. I'm helping as many people as I can, but I'm doing the best I can. If anybody who has money and wants to do good and would like to sponsor some people, please contact us, because we have people that said, if I could only have a little someone to lend a hand or whatever, I would love to be there. My heart is yearning to be with you. And I said, well, the best I can do is ask people I know within the Urantia readership, we have people that are blessed with money, and if someone wants to help out, we do have people that are asking for sponsorship, and that would be so greatly appreciated. So on the website, tuff.org, you can see my email. You can email me or contact me, and then I would be able to, I would be more than happy to say to some souls waiting, hey, guess what? God send. You can come. Be with us. So I'm glad I mentioned it because it's going to be a unique event.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you
God
for all your
you.
Work. Crystal and
Well, thank you, Diane. Yeah.
Thank
I
you,
think
everyone.
It's
thank
be
God.
A real, really beautiful once-in-a-lifetime kind of experience.
Yes.
So I
yeah,
really
yeah.
recommend that listeners who are interested in joining us, please do whatever you can to be able to come and participate.
Right.
But mostly I want to say, and without crying, I just want to say I'm very moved. Thank you to Jesus. It's all Him.
Mm-hmm.
It's Him who's orchestrating all. I'm sorry. I know I'm a crybaby, but I'll get over
not.
It. I'll get over it. But it's His event. He is the one guiding us to go there. And it's His call of the soul. And I think that we have to say thank you, Jesus Christ, Michael. He's at the source of it. So we can thank one another. We love one another. But thank you to Him because it's His event and it's His birthday. It's His celebration and it's the first time that we will be there. And I just can't say thank you enough.
Well,
we love Him.
Thank you for saying that. And I invite you to stay on if you'd like, Diane, or if you got to go about your business, that's fine. We have two, but you're welcome to join us for the second part of the show, which is we continue on with the seraphic planetary government, and we actually have Charles and Neil with us on the line. Good morning, you guys.
Hi, I just checked in, listed to
Neil.
Diane's interesting presentation.
Well, thank you. That was. It's going to be a wonderful event, and I hope, Charles, I know you'll probably be there, or Neil, it would be great to see you there, too.
Thank you very much. I have other commitments, but I appreciate the invitation.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm planning on being there. It's such an interesting and unusual confluence of presences, forces, conditions, persons. The fifth epical revelation has drawn us there, and it's the site of celestial government, and including an archangel divisional headquarters, in a place of with great natural architecture, which is not a contrast to, but a comparison to, say, human Gothic architecture. But this is naturally Gothic.
Yeah.
If I may use the term,
that's a
it's
really
a combination of all that, I think, that
visual.
makes it unusual and extraordinary. And not just unusual, but it's extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
And I find it amazing. I'm using the adjective in the sense that it's used in the great song about Jesus. It should be amazing.
Yeah. Have you been there before, Charles?
No, although I felt drawn to it for the last 40 years or so.
Oh, wow. Well, it's pretty profound just being there. I mean, you have a profound experience just being in the giant redwoods, aside from being there with like-minded, deeply spiritual human beings who are reverent and worshipful. It's just, I hope that they don't have to peel us off the trees by the time we're ready to come home.
I think it will strengthen our faith. Of all of us who go there, at least it certainly can. And I see it as an honor and as a joy, both as an honor and a joy. And the combination of the two constitute a blessing. It's a great blessing to even know about it, let alone attend it. It'll be a greater blessing to attend it and to pray and worship there and hold conversation with kindred minds and kindred souls. In this extraordinary place.
One of the things that in the Urantia book that we're encouraged to worship God in nature, you know, the way Jesus did. And I think this is a really remarkable opportunity to do that as a group in such a profoundly spectacular setting.
Probably unparalleled anywhere on earth, I think. You know, there's probably places just as beautiful, but I can't imagine that there's anywhere more beautiful than the place that this is. So.
Well, these trees are living organisms.
Mm-hmm.
The rocks are grand. Mountains and rocks can be grand, but they're not living in that sense. They also, the trees are like cities. They hold hundreds and hundreds of species of all kinds, from plants to insects to birds to mammals to reptiles. So that each tree is a city of nature, as well as a naturally Gothic structure in its verticality. The Gothic churches were designed to encourage the believer to look upward. And we will be bringing God to this place, although God's already there in terms of the angels, the various types of angels, other beings who reside there or use it. And we not only know to look up, but also to look within. It just is glorious.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be wonderful. And so here we are talking about the seraphic planetary government and the place that they meet. And Kristen, can you give us an update on where we left off last week? And where?
Well, thanks to my awkward technical challenges, and we jumped around a little bit because I was trying to get us to actually have read the seraphic the Master Seraphim section of paper 114 before Diane came on the air. But we got involved in a lot of discussion, as we always do when we're reading a paper as stimulating as this one is. So we didn't actually get to reading that section. So I'd like to read that section and then go back to some of the sections we skipped over. And if that's okay.
Recap a little bit? Yeah, absolutely.
I don't have my my section up, though, so I'm hoping somebody else can read it.
Which section, Crystal? What number?
The board of number two?
Section six, I think she's talking
about. Section six.
Oh, mm-hmm. Six, okay.
Right to the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision.
Do you want to read it, Charles?
Okay.
Are you queued up?
Well, I'm using my book.
Okay, great.
Using the phone, not the computer. I don't like looking at a monitor very long. So I prefer to use my book.
I appreciate that.
I'll be pleased to read it.
Thank you. Number six,
the Master Seraphim Planetary Supervision. When the first Governor General arrived in Urantia, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth, he was accompanied by 12 corps of special seraphim, Seraphington graduates, who were immediately assigned to certain special planetary services. These exalted angels are known as the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision and are, aside from the overcontrol of the Planetary Most High Observer, under the immediate direction of the resident Governor General. These 12 groups of angels, while functioning under the general supervision of the resident Governor General, are immediately directed by the Seraphic Council of 12, the acting chiefs of each group. This council also serves as the voluntary cabinet of the resident Governor General. As Planetary Chief of Seraphim, I preside over this council of Seraphic Chiefs, and I am a volunteer Supernafin of the Primary Order serving on Urantia as the successor of the one-time chief of the angelic host of the planet who defaulted at the time of the Caligastia secession. The 12 corps of the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision are functional on Urantia as follows. Number one, the epical angels. These are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. The present core of epical angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation. Two, the progress angels. These seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary progress of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. The group now on duty is the second to be assigned to the planet. The religious guardians, three. These are the angels of the churches, the earnest contenders for that which is and has been. They endeavor to maintain the ideals of that which has survived for the sake of the safe transit of moral values from one epoch to another. They are the checkmates of the angels of progress, all the while seeking to translate from one generation to another the imperishable values of the old and passing forms into the new, and therefore less stabilized patterns of thought and conduct. These angels do contend for spiritual forms, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial divisions of professed religions. The core now functioning Urantia is the fifth thus to serve. Four, the angels of nation life. They are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia national life. The group now functioning in the over-control of international relations is the fourth core to serve on the planet. It is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men. Five, the angels of the races. Those who work for the conservation of the evolutionary races of time, regardless of their political entanglements and religious groupings. On Urantia, there are remnants of nine human races, which have commingled and combined into the people of modern times. These seraphim are closely associated with the ministry of the race commissioners, and the group now in Urantia is the original core assigned to the planet soon after the day of Pentecost. Six, the angels of the future. These are the projection angels who forecast the future age and plan for the realization of the better things of a new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of the successive eras. The group now on the planet has thus functioned since the beginning of the current dispensation. Seven, the angels of enlightenment. Urantia is now receiving the help of the third core of seraphim dedicated to the fostering of planetary education. These angels are occupied with mental and moral training as it concerns individuals, families, groups, schools, communities, nations, and whole races. Eight, the angels of health. These are the seraphic ministers assigned to the assistance of those mortal agencies dedicated to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. The present core is the sixth group to serve during the dispensation. Nine, the home seraphim. Urantia now enjoys the services of the fifth group of angelic ministers dedicated to the preservation and advancement of the home, the basic institution of human civilization. 10. The angels of industry. This seraphic group is concerned with fostering industrial development and improving economic conditions among the Urantia peoples. This core has been seven times changed since the bestowal of Michael. 11. The angels of diversion. These are the seraphim who foster the values of play, humor, and rest. They ever seek to uplift man's recreational diversions and thus to promote a more profitable utilization of human leisure. The present core is the third in that order, of that order, to minister on Urantia. 12. The angels of superhuman ministry. These are the angels of the angels. Those seraphim who are assigned to the ministry of all other superhuman life on the planet, temporary or permanent. This core has served since the beginning of the current dispensation. When these groups of master seraph and disagree in matters of planetary policy or procedure, their differences are usually composed by the Governor General. But all his rulings are subject to appeal in accordance with the nature and gravity of the issues involved in the disagreement. None of these angelic groups exercise direct or arbitrary control over the domains of their assignment. They cannot fully control the affairs of their respective realms of action, but they can and do so manipulate planetary conditions and so associate circumstances as favorably to influence the spheres of human activity to which they are attached. The Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision utilize many agencies for the prosecution of their missions. They function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. While unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. But aside from these many means of positive action, the Master Seraphim ensure planetary progress against vital jeopardy through the mobilization, training, and maintenance of the reserve corps of destiny. The chief function of these reservists is to ensure against breakdowns of evolutionary progress. They are the provisions which the celestial forces have made against surprise. They are the guarantees against disaster. I find it fascinating and realistic, sensible, that such insurance policy is necessary, even by those that have tremendous power. It tells me that the existence of the Reserve Corps indicates to me that the celestials don't use the power arbitrarily, that there's some rationale that the universe brings to this. And I find that reassuring.
Oh, absolutely reassuring. This is just probably one of the most amazing things in the Urantia book, this division of the angels in the 12 cores. And it really shows how our evolution has been divided in terms of celestial desire and authority and you know, projection for our future. And each one of these cores, we'll read in the Reserve Corps of Destiny, is entitled to their complement. Probably not the Angels of Superhuman Ministry, I don't think would be, but the
No, I disagree
one.
With that.
You do?
I do.
Okay,
yeah, I think
so,
the Angels of Superhuman Ministry as well would have their complement.
Huh, okay, that's good. I would like to think that. You know, I don't know how, you know, but that's touching, Andre, really, because I think that, we tend to think of them as in an abstract way sometimes, but their heart, they feel like we feel, and their hearts are touched by our ministry. So that idea that we might minister to them, that's really an amazing thought.
I would like to comment on one of the points that Charles made, having to do with the relative discipline and organizational patterns that the Chief of Seraphim has just described. Now, in the third paragraph from the end of the section that Charles read, the author states, none of these angelic groups exercise direct or arbitrary control over the domains of their assignment. I think that sentence is extremely important because it means that they are in the background. They are not giving mm-hmm. orders to human beings. If we talk about the nature of angels, there is a psychological element here that is, in my opinion, worth focusing on. In paper 38, which is also written by the same author, the Chief of Seraphim, she comments on the use of different kinds of pronouns for different beings derived from the persons of the Paradise Trinity, and says, this is on page 419, paragraph 2, which is in turn in section 2 of paper 38. In dealing with sex creatures, it is our custom to speak of those beings of more direct descent from the Father and the Son as the sons of God. while referring to the children of the Spirit as the daughters of God. Angels are therefore commonly designated by feminine pronouns on the sex planets. Now, you, as experienced readers of the Urantia book, are aware of this, but many people do not focus on the implications. Yes, we're not talking about sexual beings in the sense of human beings having two sexes, but nevertheless, the use of feminine pronouns to me is symbolic, and it corresponds to the point that the seraphim support, provide assistance, do not give orders. Yes, we're talking about, shall we say, stereotypical patterns of human society, but nonetheless, the distinction compared with traditional religion in the Western world is very significant. Traditional religion in the Western world has focused on authority, telling people what to do and what to believe. Mm-hmm. And the contrast I am making is that this is not authority in terms of telling people what to do. The master seraphim are helping. They cannot control the areas of their assignment. In the end, as Charles pointed out, if there is an emergency, they have a fallback method. They can resort to the Reserve Corps of Destiny. But the first two paragraphs at the end, those preceding the paragraph that refers to the Reserve Corps of Destiny, describe their normal methods, which is to say, to manipulate planetary conditions, associate circumstances, function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. They're working in human mind. Mm-hmm. It states in the second paragraph from the end, part of the comments by the Chief of Seraphim, that they are unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human mm-hmm. minds. But, it goes on in the same sentence, they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. So we're talking about stimulus, we're talking about encouragement, we're talking about ways perhaps to help human beings uplift, upgrade, improve our concepts of how we relate to each other, how we live on Urantia in harmonious and peaceful ways. And they are not giving orders.
I want to share a quote that is so pertinent to what you just said, Neil. It's from paper 54, Problems of the Lucifer Rebellion. But it's one that just always comes back to me in light of what these angels do and what the whole celestial realm does to help us within the rule, the laws of the universe, and certainly free will is one of those big laws. And it says, how dare the self-willed creature encroach upon the rights of his fellows in the name of personal liberty when the supreme rulers of the universe stand back in merciful respect of these prerogatives of will and potentials of personality. No being in the exercise of his supposed personal liberty has the right to deprive any other being of those privileges of existence conferred by the creators and duly respected by all their loyal associates, subordinates, and subjects. This is just, you know, we talk about the, you know, we did the planet government on a neighboring planet, and the prime directive was brought up several times, but this merciful respect of the prerogatives of will and the potentials of personality, that's you know, like the law of all laws in the universe, at least that's what I get. You know,
I think you're completely right about that, Crystal, and the point is we
are
not
puppets.
That was
actually Paula.
That was Paula. No,
sorry,
no
Paula.
Problem.
Please excuse me for mistaking your voice.
Oh, no problem.
The point here is that we are not puppets. We're not marionettes.
Right.
If we were marionettes, then who would the credit rest with? The credit would rest with the puppet master. Instead, we have our own free will. And it is this possibility of contributing freely of our own choices
mm-hmm.
that causes the credit to rest with us in the long run. I'm talking about the people of Urantia. It is the ministry of the Master Seraphim that is intended to encourage human beings to make those choices and decisions that will cause our society, our civilization, our planet to rise to higher levels. And because they must respect our free will, because we have the opportunity to make these choices, therefore, we are contributing as human beings, we are contributing as a society, and we are part of the unification of the grand universe that the Supreme Being is fostering. We can share in this growth of the Supreme Being. Whereas if we were controlled, if we were given orders, if we were puppets, it would simply be to the credit of the people who were controlling us.
Well, I think that's so important, is the point that Neil is making, that it does seem to, as a condition of service from the angelic point of view, as a condition of service on a planet, any inhabited planet, particularly in the Agandanta ones such as ours, that the human free will seems to shape the nature of the service that angels provide, which can be summarized in essentially two nouns, to guard and to guide. The book uses the phrases at least twice, and I believe it's used in the context of the seraphic destiny guardians, but I think it applies to the master seraphim in the sense that they too guard. We have a reserve corps, it's part of guarding, and guide, and they and there's a sense, in that sense, the angelic, and as I see it, as I understand it, the angelic, the nature of the angelic function, both as destiny, seraphic guardians, and the master seraphim overlap in the guarding and the guiding facets of their service. And between them, persons, individual and groups of persons, are guarded and guided, and likewise for families and nations and races and the whole planet. I see a marvelous unity, functional unity in all this, and a profound respect, as Neil emphasized, to human free will, to mortal free will. And one other aspect of this that intrigues me, Neil also alluded to the fact that angels on the procreational worlds are characterized as daughters of God. And I think guarding and guiding, this is a little bit of a stretch. I mean, certainly men do the same, the male can do the same thing. But I think basically the guarding and guiding functionality reflects a kind of, almost a kind of maternal or motherly protection and service. And that's very fitting, if it follows, it's very fitting, since they are the creatures of the local universe mother spirit. And again, I think that, I see that as part of the unity as well, unity of service as well.
So true. Well, you know, so what intrigues me then about this is the difficulty of this task. Certainly they're here for the long run, and you know, they share all of our, the Urantia book says they share all of our non-sensual emotions except fear. And why would they be afraid? I mean, they're not subject to physical pain, and I think that's probably what makes most people afraid. Is remember, you know, they remember once when they were in pain and it was really awful, and so they fear being in pain again, and that really is the essence of fear, in my opinion. It's remembered pain. But I so appreciate their work, because I think about what they've contributed in terms of just their patience, their diligence, their careful consideration, their love, their devotion. You know, and really, we humans proceed almost completely oblivious to them. Mm. So they don't get a whole lot of gratitude from us. And yet there's, as the Reserve Court goes on to say, there's certainly those humans who willingly enlist or are their complement and so crucial to what they're trying to do. And I like to think of it as, you know, we become their heart, their hands, their eyes, their ears. We give the hugs. We sit and listen. We do the ministry that they would do if they could.
I think
one of
that,
the other.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Whoever was coming
in. That was crystalline. One of the other things that I find really intriguing about this section is the fact that they try to provide favorable conditions
mm-hmm.
in our on our planet and our world and our environment. And just like to speculate a little bit about how that might be.
Are you going to speculate, or are you just asking us to
speculate? I'm asking for us to collectively speculate.
Yeah, and maybe there's a historical point of view where we can see where they've actually had an effect, or, you know, maybe speculate about that.
Well, I have two ideas, but I'll right now yield to Neil or Andre, if you wish to, or anyone else.
I think that the question of favorable conditions has to be understood in the context of the idea of mind, ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. There is a certain synchronicity of what happens in human life. Unfortunately, we include in our character problem avoidance, problem postponement. And so, in answer to the idea of speculating, it may be necessary for the Master Seraphim to contribute, in some cases, to a kind of urgency or an atmosphere of crisis, at least intellectually or spiritually. And then, maybe some people will come up with new ideas. New ideas do not arise because people are going out to play golf. They arise because someone is thinking about a problem, and perhaps the Seraphim can help that person focus. But what I'm suggesting to you is that if there is no consciousness in human mind that the circumstances of this particular corner of human life are not fully satisfactory, then the person will not be thinking about how to solve that problem. In other words, one element of perhaps emphasizing the value of new approaches may be to stimulate a consciousness of insufficiency, a consciousness of problems. And I'm just offering that as you asked me to do, a bit of speculation.
I think you're on the right track, Neil, and I'm suspecting that Charles will echo that as well. But to me, it takes me... I think it's wonderful to look at paper 19. I think is where you derived some of what you were indicating in terms of problem solving and some of that. There's also just thinking of both Jesus' pronouncement and the echoing of that in the book, and that is, tempt not your angels to lead you in troublous ways, and that is actually a positive affirmation that our angels will lead us into troublous ways if we need it. And not trouble to our souls, but trouble for our souls to have to grapple with.
Yeah, to stimulate that grappling mechanism.
And how that is underscored is near the end of part three in Supreme and Ultimate and Time and Space, under the section Functions of Providence, where under that section in, I'll say, paragraph, is it 9? Let me double check. Yeah, I think it is. Some of the amazingly fortuitous conditions occasionally prevailing on the evolutionary worlds may be due to the gradually emerging presence of the Supreme, the foretasting of his future universe activities. Well, we know that. But most of what, they don't say but I did, most of what a mortal would call providential is not. His judgment of such matters is very handicapped by lack of far-sighted vision into the true meanings of the circumstances of life. Much of what a mortal would call good luck might really be bad luck. The smile of fortune that bestows unearned leisure and undeserved wealth may be the greatest of human afflictions. The apparent cruelty of a perverse fate that heaps tribulation upon some suffering mortal may in reality be the tempering fire that is transmuting the soft iron of immature personality into the tempered steel of real character. That may offer a clue as to what the angels are cooperating with.
Right.
I agree with you, Andre. I would like to double back a bit to Charles's comparison with the guardian seraphim. I agree that the spirit of guarding and guiding is included in the work of the master seraphim. The other side of it, though, is that the focus of ministry is different. All of us have a guardian seraphim. Of course, the group guardians correspond to people in the outer circles of human development, but all of us have a group guardian or a personal guardian, one or the other. In contrast, I doubt very much that all of us are personally receiving the inspiration of the Master Seraphim. They have a very specific purpose. Mm-hmm. They are striving to improve human society and civilization by causing humanity as a whole to reach higher levels of development. And their function of stimulating ideas, to me, suggests that they have to economize their effort by focusing on people who have ideas, who are grappling with these issues. Now, in fairness, most human beings do not. Most human beings pass through life fulfilling their duties, perhaps, as Andre has implied, dealing with difficult circumstances, but not really focused on trying to improve the circumstances in which they are engaged one way or another. So it seems to me that the Master Seraphim have to focus more narrowly on people who have some potential for contributing to the advance of humanity, or at least on people who have some ideas that could be enhanced or developed for the purpose of improving the circumstances of human life on our planet.
I would add groups to that, too. You know, I'm sure you...
Yes, I agree.
...meant that as well. Yeah. Well, Charles, you had some thoughts you wanted to share, too. What do you still have those?
Oh, yes.
Okay, yes, I thought so.
I'll hazard an attempt to use broad examples from the human historical record and to speculatively read into them to some extent, inferring Master Seraphim actions from the descriptions of those functions in the book to what we know of the human story. However, there's a caveat with all this, and I'll acknowledge it at the beginning. And I have these two examples. One deals with international power, politics, and war. The other deals with education. Mm. I'll try to be brief. The problem is human bias when reading into them. I acknowledge that, and bias comes in all kinds of forms, both positive and negative. Patriotism can lead one to a bias, for instance, mm-hmm. just as well as bigotry. Well, with that in mind, notwithstanding that, it seems to me in the 20th century we have at least two examples on a worldwide basis of mortal threats, a very grim threats to evolutionary progressive civilization, Nazism and communism. Hmm. Both have a great deal in common. They're both socialistic. They both practice the cult of the worship of the cult of the individual, human being, that is, the leader. Stalin in one case, Lenin, Hitler in the other case. They both had political parties that dominated, where sovereignty truly was. It wasn't in the governments. Their governments. Sovereignty was really in the political parties, the Communist Party and Nazi Party. And this is a distortion in terms of the tradition of liberal democratic democracy going back several hundred years. We've gone back to the Greeks, really, in a sense. Well, I wonder if the angels of nation life, the fourth core that's listed in our book, did not intervene in both mm-hmm. the... To prompt FDR. FDR prepared for World War II long before Pearl Harbor. And he did it. He even said he might get impeached for the things that he did. And then we had Truman, right after World War, had to deal with the Cold War, which threatened a Third World War, which continually threatened a Third World War. It seems to me, and I'm not, I remember as a boy in Catholic school, when I was in about the third grade, early 1950s, we were taught that the church was dedicated to the overthrow of communism. That was considered the central priority of the church. I remember the nun telling us that. I was young, but I was very taken by that. And I wonder, I imagine the angels of nation life, the Master Seraphim, could so act, and to ensure victory for the United States, without being a partisan of the United States. I'm not implying one follows the other at all, because Lincoln didn't during the Civil War. He took a different view that God's purposes transcended both sides. And that's the perspective that I apply here. But I suspect, looking back, going through it and looking back on the Cold War and then studying the Second World War and its origin and history and development and all that, it seems to me it's not unreasonable to postulate that the angels of nation life may have indeed intervened to ensure victory, to defeat Nazism and then communism. If either one of those had won, as Churchill put it, civilization itself would have been threatened. The very nature of civilization, not just land grabs, but civilization itself was threatened. He said, if we lose in England, civilization on Earth may enter a new dark age, made more sinister by modernity, its industry, its science, its technology. The other example is education. And I'm wondering if the seven core, the seven angels of enlightenment that deal with education, don't function. And as a teacher, I tried to discern what their interests might be and actually apply it to my curriculum. I made bold
Very
to do
good.
This. This is what I came up with. This is what I would practice. This is how I understood it and actually taught it to public high school students for the better part of 40 years. It seems to me, if I was an angel of enlightenment, that's the question I asked myself, what would I value with a curriculum, informing a curriculum? And it would be at least some of these highlights. Integrating, or trying to integrate the humanities and sciences, art history with general history, literature, history, and art, taking that kind of integrative approach, because that leads to a higher level of thinking, and
more
that
holistic.
Opens you to be more open to revelatory direction. I'll stop it at that.
Well, I just was struck by that, and I thought of you, Charles, when we read that together. I thought, wow, you know, mental and moral training, and the many things that you said while we were going through Government on a Neighboring Planet, and the importance of moral training, and how little of that occurs yet, you know. But still, I'm struck by this idea that. You know, also how long they've been here, the various cores, some of them have been here for quite a long time, and you think that, okay, 10,000 years, one human lifetime is 1% of that time that they have here. And so they're dealing with, you know, from the time perspective, that's what always kind of strikes me too, is, you know, they have to make these changes gradually over time. And certainly they intervene, as you have pointed out, in a crisis to stop that, you know, from creating a huge barrier to progress. You know, we know that God's will win out in the end. We know that the meek shall inherit the earth, and the words that Jesus spoke will rule this world. We know that's a given. But we have to go through more or less difficulty trying to get to that place, and I'm sure they would want us to go through, you know, to get there as efficiently as possible without huge gaps. And so each human life, just a small percentage of the time that they're here and these various groups of humans that they have to work with to create over time a fabric. So it's like each one of us is a thread, and we're woven into this tapestry of evolution that they're helping us create. It's really astonishing to me, the work they do and how effective they are. And the reason I say that is because as we read this, I couldn't help but think of people who perhaps haven't read the Urantia book, maybe our listeners who are thinking, well, gee, these angels aren't doing a very good job. And that's why I so, you know, really, and that's why I so appreciate your historical perspective, Charles, and yours too, Neil, because it shows us that, you know, we have to get that cosmic perspective of time. You know, we're locked into our own time, and we can't see the progress that they see that we've
right.
made. And perhaps we can't see the great enemies to that progress that they see. You know, we're blinded to some of those things because we're so circumspect. So,
especially where they say that, you know, one of the quotes you read about, you know, the things that we think of as being beneficial are frequently quite the opposite, and vice versa. Those
right.
things that are very painful struggles for us to deal with are frequently the things that most help us in making moral progress.
Yes, it's more obvious perhaps when you have a grave planetary emergency such
mm-hmm.
as posed by forces, the Nazis and communists, forces. Anybody who's ever studied either one or both would understand what I'm talking about. The Soviet Union maintained hundreds and hundreds of permanent concentration camps, slave labor, and death camps. The Nazis are legendary for their death camps as well as concentration camps. Dirkheim was a concentration camp, by the way, used slave labor with the intention that they would eventually die off. A death camp was designed strictly to kill people as many as fast as possible. And they institutionalized such attitudes. They actually made them institutions. That kind of the presence of those kinds of forces is such a aberrant contrast to even non-spiritual, just ethical notions of the good, that it's easier to find them. It's not as easy when you're lazy and things are done, or a nation is lazy, or a race is lazy, or a city is lazy, or however it's grouped around, are morally lazy or morally indifferent, etc., to their own character, the growth of their own character. And that hardships, it's hard to see how hardships are positive, but they certainly can be from the long view point of view. For if you don't have a character, you don't develop character, you don't have a future. You can't. It's not possible. And a hardship, suffering, is a mirror that tells the truth. In suffering, you usually see what character you actually have, not what you think you have or other people think you have, what you actually have, because it's tested in a material environment dramatically, either sooner or later, and it becomes very evident. But to view that from the standpoint of the angelic helpers requires more insight, I think, and is almost counterintuitively. But when you look at it from the standpoint of the long view, it makes a great deal. It makes perfect sense.
I agree with all the examples that Charles has given, and I would just comment for the benefit of our listeners that we who are speaking to you today are not experts in all fields of human life, and the examples that we come up with are influenced by our personal backgrounds, obviously. The element that I find very challenging in the situation of humanity right now pertains to maintaining a balance of all kinds of social factors, along with the exploration and discovery of scientific and technical achievements that have occurred in the last several hundred years. And this is difficult because in the past, and perhaps even at present, discoveries in science have been turned to destructive purposes. For example, the discovery of nuclear energy came to the world first as the atomic bomb. And the era that Charles described was also an era of great fear that civilization would be destroyed because that there would be a huge war. Now, in the paper on planetary mortal epochs, the author, A Mighty Messenger, comments that discovery normally becomes a key issue in the post-Adamic dispensation. He calls it an age of great invention, energy control, and mechanical development. He states that this is the era of the appearance of multiform manufacture and the control of natural forces. For those who want to find that quotation, it's on page 593 in the one-column edition in section 3 of paper 52, analytically. Now, the mighty messenger goes on and says, much of the material progress occurs during this time of the inauguration of the development of the physical sciences, just such an epoch as Urantia is now experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Your world is a full dispensation and more behind the average planetary schedule. So just to tie this together, the problem that must be one of those more serious issues that the Master Seraphim are addressing now is how to keep in check this tendency to use scientific discovery and innovation in ways that hurt people rather than help. For example, on a more neutral level, we have advances in information technology. We have advances in communication. On the other hand, there are tendencies on the part of government institutions to pry into personal matters where they should not be. So how do the Seraphim protect personal privacy or, shall we say, help human beings make a reasonable balance between the needs of security authorities to protect against terrorist actions and so on, at the same time protecting privacy? Because if human beings are constantly under the thumb of police or other government organizations, free will is lost. So in giving these examples, I'm simply trying to say that the underlying challenges that the Master Seraphim face must always bear in mind the need for balance among a variety of different factors that contribute to society and civilization. And that, I think, is one reason to be very patient with them. After all, it is human beings who have to make these improvements, and the Seraphim can inspire us, but they cannot do it. We have to do it ourselves.
Which brings home the reason why this honoring of free will is so paramount and so important. I think of that other great quote that free will is the greatest gift we can give God. In fact, it's the only gift that has any value. Any real value to our Heavenly Father, our choice to do His will, because we do choose to do it. And, you know, to bring that about in the collective, I mean, that to me, that's the difficulty of their task. You know, they can inspire us individually, but to just, and we know because we are isolated, that makes their task even that much more difficult. If we had our Adam and Eve here, they would inspire us. And we would have our universal representation here. We would, you know, we wouldn't doubt so much that we're not alone in the universe if we had beings that had been on the planet for 37,000 years. And there was a garden and a culture that grew up around them and their many children. And, you know, all of those things would have conspired to help us come to these conclusions. Our angels are at a great disadvantage, I think. Not that they're not up to the task, but because we don't have those material factors that help us, and because we are Agendanters, you know, so even more so than most planets, their work is really cut out for them with us.
Well, you once said, Paula, one of our conversations, and it's so profoundly true, the angels accept what's given them. We are what's given them.
Right.
They're not at liberty to necessarily, and they may volunteer for this or they may not, but they're not at liberty to not serve, once they accept, not serve what they have in front of them. And I think we should be inspired as mortals, likewise, when we serve our fellows or we disagree with our fellows, etc. That's part of being godlike. Not being God, I don't mean to say that, but to be godlike. Jesus knew what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was doing when he told Gabriel to announce at some point that Urantia was the place. He was coming here. Mm. He knew the risks.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. It makes it all the more beautiful. I mean, he surrendered consciousness as the greatest in our universe, personality in the universe. He surrendered consciousness in a very dangerous place. And remember that he had to live his life principally with being guided by the divine spirit. He didn't fall on. There were occasional supernatural or supermaterial experiences, but he didn't fall back on it. He could have, but he didn't. Essentially, he lived immortally. He lived as a man among men with the divine spirit, the same as we have to.
Mm-hmm.
Same as men and women, human beings have to. And the angels, no doubt, continually take inspiration from that. Well, we should also. We should take inspiration from them. They won't give. I think we can have confidence they won't give up on us. Not individually, not institutionally, not worldwide.
Not in any way.
And we shouldn't give up on them, and we shouldn't give up on God and Michael, and we shouldn't give up on each other. There may be all kinds of tactical method, pedagogical adjustments to be made within that framework. But the essential faith intent, we should hold on to that. And isn't that our beauty and glory? As Agandantas, we hold on to that faith intent. We don't let it go, no matter what. No matter what. We may be knocked down. We may be hurt. We may be killed, murdered, as often prophets have been. We may be mocked and ridiculed, but we should not mock back or ridicule back. That's what we should stand firmly as best we can with the fruits of the Spirit. And the angels, I'm sure, are doing their best to stand by the fruits of the Spirit. I love them and admire them and respect them all.
I also
with you.
Think about the kinds of crushing disappointments that we experience when our plans don't go as we'd wished. And then I think about how much more, in a way, they must have to deal with disappointments of plans that they may have been trying to initiate maybe for hundreds of years and having them go astray or go afoul because someone maybe just got distracted, didn't pay attention at the right moment or didn't follow through on some opportunity presented. And I just think that we're admonished to make fewer plans regarding other free will personalities, or that this is one way for us to experience fewer disappointments. And just what an amazing role model they must be for living that truth.
Mm. Well, in our last 2.5 minutes, what strikes me just quickly is that their plans can't be all that feeble, and I think that's something that as we pursue this study and specifically, go forward in some of the ways that Neil might be directing us, I think this could be very interesting in discovering just how robust these plans are, when we really think about them, and how little they depend on necessarily particular personalities, but on the principles that may be embodied by those that have proven themselves to be trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they surely are trying to do is to bring each of us as individuals into a place where each of us is much more trustworthy and much more dedicated to some aspect of something that we find valuable and worthwhile to pursue.
Hmm.
I agree with you, Andre, and I would add to what you've just said the importance of mutual respect for differences of opinion, the importance of pluralism, the importance of diversity. The fourth paragraph from the end of the section that Charles read says that when these groups of Master Seraphim disagree in matters of planetary policy or procedure, their differences are usually composed by the Governor General, but all his rulings are subject to appeal in accordance with the nature and gravity of the issues involved in the disagreement. I think we should reflect on what this means. All the Master Seraphim are graduates of Seraphington. They were Seraphim on the original in the original local universe where they were created, but they went all the way up to Seraphington and they have come back. Nevertheless, with all the wisdom they accumulated, they may disagree with each other. And if they disagree with each other, the Governor General, who is a very important person in the overall administration of the planet, may make a ruling. But if people are still not happy, then it can be appealed. Now, I think this really creates a presumption of diversity, not just one viewpoint triumphing over others. And the issue of balance is implicit. The description of the Urmia lectures that Jesus gave refers to a disagreement between two corps of Master Seraphim. So the point here that I'm trying to make is that we should let go of the tradition in Western religion and spirituality of saying everything must be my way. No, there is a respect for others. There is a respect for pluralism. There is a respect for diversity. And these are extremely important elements.
Beautifully said. Thank you. And, you know, we've come to the end of our show. We're now being recorded. Krislyn, perhaps you can fill us in on what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. And
well, we're going to continue on and finish this paper, and then we're going to have a more in-depth study that is then based on Neil's research or Neil's work on the Master Seraphim.
Wonderful.
I think the statement you've just made is very heartwarming for me personally. I had discussed with you the possibility that we, the group, will reach the point of using the study guide that I prepared, which is 15 pages, as a vehicle for discussion. Is that on the table as part of what you've just said, Krislyn?
Absolutely, yes.
So if what I understand...
I have talked with you about the importance of giving people who listen to us a way to have that material in front of them. How are we going to do that? One way would be to refer to the website of the committee that I chair, the Committee for the Global Endeavor, which includes a link that will allow people to download that study guide. Is that
include that link in the blurb.
Okay.
Probably for next week.
Okay.
Because I would like to put it out there as soon as we can. We couldn't do it this week because we were including
your Rancho
Diane's
Family Festival. Yeah.
Diane's
yeah.
material. That's entirely appropriate. And I'm not sure
what
from what you
website,
said earlier
Neil?
That... Pardon me?
What is that website? And we'll put it on the board real quick, and then we'll have it also in the archive if you say it.
Sure. It's www.globalendeavor.com. As if it were one word, globalendeavor.net. And the
Great.
Link for the study guide on the Master Seraphim is toward the bottom of the page.
Okay, great.
Most of the items on that page have to do with the plan for the Global Endeavor, but the study guide on the Master Seraphim is identified in the link near the bottom of the homepage.
Okay.
And I assume, Krislyn and Paula, that your intention is to go back to the sections of paper 114 that we haven't had time to discuss. Am I correct? 3 and 4
yes.
and 5?
Yes.
And also 7.
Right.
Yeah. And are you planning to do that before we return to the study guide?
Yes. I'm planning to do that next week.
Okay.
We never know how far we're going to get each
right.
week because it's totally dependent on the discussion that we generate. But
sure. So it is quite possible that the discussion of these other sections 3, 4, 5, and 7 might occupy the whole program next week.
Correct.
Correct.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we could count on it.
Yeah.
But then
that
will give people a chance to download your study guide as well, and then we can start from there. So,
right.
We've really dedicated the rest of the month of May to okay. this topical study, and we may run into June, a little bit of June.
And it's a good time to say thank you so much, Neil and Charles.
Well, thank
Charles.
You, and I agree with Charles in a comment that I think he made last week that we should not
yeah.
be in a hurry.
Right.
This is important that we devote as much time and energy as we can to this and not feel that we are obliged to run a race.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm so glad you feel that way. Thank you. Because, you know, it sometimes I think our last study was very good because we took time to do it. And I think this one will be outstanding for the same reason. And I so appreciate you both being here for the duration and being willing to do that with us. It just means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Adding quite a bit. And I'm sure our listeners, all of them are getting a great deal out of all the sharing that's going on as a result of your participation, Charles and Neil.
Well, thank you.
So thank you so much. And we will be back next week with more on the Seraphic Planetary Government with Neil Waldrop and Charles Olivier. For myself, Paula Thompson, Crystalline Beek-Larson, and Andre Redatis, we thank you for listening, and we hope you'll tune in next week. And until then, we'll just say bye for now.
Bye. Bye-bye. From the Cosmic Citizen.
Bye.
Adios.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the host, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.